Massive hijacked gas and chemical tankers roam the seas, a floating fortress allowing pirates to operate away from land for months.
The global shipping security body, the International Maritime Bureau, says more people were taken hostage at sea in 2010 than in any other year on record.
Unless this growing tide on piracy is turned soon, the International Maritime Bureau warns that qualified seafarers may simply abandon their merchant vessels and crucial international trade could sink.
While piracy has always existed, through most of the 20th century, it posed no real threat to maritime trade. And piracy was confined to the pages of history books and Hollywood films. That, however, has all changed with the growth of piracy off the coast of Somalia. Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and via the web. Today, we take a look at Somali piracy. While there are no written records, it seems clear as long as people have had ships, there has been piracy. And according to Bob Davis, Professor of History at Ohio State University, there are certain preconditions necessary for piracy to exist.
The thing about the sea is, the sea belongs to no one. And consequently, what really determines the possibility of piracy is whether local powers are strong enough to patrol the seas, to just keep an eye on the seas, to be a cop on the beat. And if they're not, almost inevitably somebody will attempt to sneak out into this common open territory and grab whatever they can. Piracy is basically armed seafarers attacking unarmed merchant ships. That's what makes it all go. Obviously, no pirate's going to make a living attacking armed naval vessels. That's crazy. So you need to have a vibrant maritime economy. And the more vibrant, in some ways, the better. That's why, for example, the great piracy explosion in the 17th and 18th century in the Caribbean really took off, because the Americas themselves were taking off, and the Atlantic as a major economic axis as trade increased many times over. The classic image we have of pirates is always they end up burying their treasure. Well, that's just stupid. You can't bury your treasure. It doesn't make any sense. If you bury your treasure, you've got nothing. Why even do it? And of course, very rarely is pirate loot a trunk full of jewels and diadems and gold and stuff like that. Very often, pirate loot is going to be cloth or corn or slaves even sometimes, or goods, in other words, wine, things like that. And it's necessary to unload this stuff somehow. And so what you need is somebody who's willing to buy your stuff. Really, these three things. You have to have a weak situation at sea, you have to have an active trade to attack, and then you have to have a place to unload the things that you pick up. And then you will have pirates. And it's a very famous story when Julius Caesar was young, and he was doing out on one of his services to the Roman Republic out in the Eastern Mediterranean, and he was captured by, quote, pirates that came from what is now Turkey, Asia Minor. And he was captured and held captive. And he managed eventually to get away from them, to ransom himself, and then to turn right around and attack them. And he can attack them because they are pirates. In other words, they are not a legitimate nation that you have to have relationships with or declare war on if you don't want to or you have a fight. Anybody can attack pirates anytime. That's the other side of piracy. They attack you, but you can always attack them.
The Romans, when faced with increasing piracy in the Mediterranean, responded methodically, removing every pirate base they could find. Angus Constam is a historian of piracy.
The Romans, under Pompey, the guy who landed up having a civil war with Caesar, he was given immense funds. He was given unlimited ships and men. He sealed the Straits of Gibraltar, and essentially he worked east. They just went into every port and every little haven and looked everywhere and stopped every ship and essentially worked from one end of the Mediterranean to the other. When they found a base, they encircled it with Roman legionaries and killed or captured everyone inside. They just worked their way along. So after that, the Mediterranean was essentially a Roman lake.
Angus Constam argues that until the advent of the modern navy, there was a direct crossover between privateers and pirates.
Throughout these periods in history, especially in the 18th century, you get a lot of people who've worked as privateers, which is essentially a form of legalized pirate. When two countries are fighting each other, especially in the age of sail, they give out privateering licenses, and the government would encourage these people to attack enemy ships. The government then got 10 or 20% of the cut. Essentially, it was a form of legalized piracy. But the trouble is, these contracts, these privateering contracts or letters of marque, were only good while the war lasted. When the war ended, they were ripped up and the people were out of a job. So they could either go back to the regular day-to-day job of being a seaman, or they could continue exactly what they were doing before, except doing it as illegal pirates, as people working outside the law. So that means that it tends to be after a big war and employment of lots of sailors, when they're thrown back onto the job market, that's when piracy starts to flare up.
One of these periods was at the beginning of the 18th century, when at the end of the War of the Spanish Succession, unemployed sailors and privateers turned en masse to piracy in the Caribbean. It's this period that's referred to as the Golden Age of Piracy. So how and why did this Golden Age come to an end?
Well, the fact that they had a number of instances where pirates were either captured and killed, or captured and then tried and executed. The famous women pirates, Anne Bonny and Mary Read, were captured along with their menage a trois with the captain, Calico Jack, and the three of them were actually captured off Jamaica and taken into Jamaica, into what's essentially now Kingston, Jamaica, Port Royal then, and they were tried, and the two women were let off because they were pregnant, but the rest of the crew were all executed. But these were kind of high-profile trials, and they were sensational at the time. They were, transcripts of them were repeated in newspapers in Europe, in the American colonies. But then also, when these people were hanged, they weren't just hanged. They then tended to take the bodies, stick them in a cage, and hang them off a headland or a promontory as a warning to other sailors. So a combination of this kind of very visible justice was also backed up by increased naval patrols. So it was a combination of things that actually made piracy something that was just not going to work anymore. The chances of getting caught had become just far too high. The last great big pirate crew was that of Bartholomew Roberts, Black Bart Roberts, who was caught off the coast of West Africa. There was a big sea battle against a British warship, HMS Swallow, and Roberts' ship was captured. He was killed in the battle, but his men were taken to the Cape Coast, and again, there was a mass execution of about 25 to 30 pirates. About the same number, again, were pardoned or imprisoned. And it was that kind of very decisive action that essentially killed off the Golden Age of piracy.
This past week, world attention has focused on a pirate attack on a US ship off the coast of Somalia.
Piracy on the high seas has reached new heights after Somali pirates hijacked a supertanker.
It seems the world has finally woken up to the piracy crisis off the coast of Somalia. Dozens of ships have been captured by pirates in recent months, and more than 250 merchant seamen are being held as hostages. Shipping companies have paid out tens of millions of dollars in ransoms.
Somalia has one of the longest coastlines in Africa. It's on the northeast corner of Africa, in the Horn of Africa, which is where the African continent and the Arabian Peninsula nearly touch.
Jeffrey Gentleman is the East African Bureau Chief for the New York Times.
It is strategically located near the Gulf of Aden, which is one of the most congested shipping channels in the world. And part of the reason why these pirates have been so successful is so many ships, something like 20 or 30,000, every year pass by the shores of Somalia.
In terms of history, the Somali piracy is a recent phenomenon. And the earliest incident of piracy, I think, was in the early 2000s when a fishing trawler was hijacked by Somali fishermen.
Paul Musili Wambua is Professor of Law at the University of Nairobi and specialises in maritime law and piracy.
So historically, one can say that the earliest recorded incidents which were publicised were starting in 2005. So we are talking about 6 years ago. From 2006, one sees some kind of increase in piracy, in fact, which far exceeds what had been recorded with the Malacca Straits piracy, the Indonesian piracy incidents, and the West African piracy.
Feeling safe in Somalia is relative. 20 years ago, the central government collapsed and the capital, Mogadishu, descended into chaos. Somalia became a failed state and its people started to die by the thousands of starvation.
Somalia's central government collapsed in 1991, and that ushered in a chapter of lawlessness and violence that began to play out on the seas as the years went on from 1991. It started from what we've been told by fishermen, Somali fishermen, lashing out at foreign fishing trawlers that were going up and down the Somali coast and just cleaning out the stocks of fish.
While the Western aid agencies worked desperately to ship food into the country, the world's fishing fleets sensed an opportunity. Somalia's 1,100-kilometer coastline was now undefended. Trawlers from Asia, the Middle East, and Europe moved in for the kill. Somalia's fishing grounds were devastated.
And often they did this, we were told, using really destructive means, that they would vacuum the bottom of the ocean floor, they would suck up rocks, plants, habitat of fish and lobsters. And so the Somali fishermen felt helpless and said that the only way they could protect their marine resources was to start capturing fishing vessels and charging them a tax.
Well, in the beginning, it wasn't very sophisticated. You have the small skiffs, fiberglass boats or wooden boats with powerful outboard and border engines. You have the odd arsenal of AK-47s, usually in a state of ill repair.
Peter Leah is a lecturer in terrorism studies at the University of St Andrews.
And basically, the reach of the pirates were as far as the outboarders of their skiffs would bring them. 50 nautical miles, then 100 nautical miles, and then further after they got some motherships, i.e. small freighters or dhows, local vessels, which could act as platforms for the pirates, towing their skiffs or having them on board to give them a wider reach. Initially, the pirates were mainly fishermen. They have the mariner skills, they live at the seaboard, they have a kind of, let's call it, maritime domain awareness. So it was a close-knit society at that time, clan-based, with a kind of code of honor, and knowing the rules of the game, not trying to overdo it, and usually actually attacking only coastal vessels. As I said, ships, for example, of the Kenyan Motaku Shipping Agency. So old vessels, small vessels, not ships on international voyage, which means, let's be very cynic, in the beginning they didn't attack us, they only attacked them, other Africans, Pakistani sailors or so, which is why piracy wasn't an issue.
So how did the world's most powerful nations have their shipping industry held to ransom by a pack of pirates here in the Gulf of Aden? Well, it's got a lot to do with the humble lobster and a place called Puntland, which until a year ago, most people had never even heard of.
The piracy began in northeast Somalia and in central Somalia. Somalia is shaped like a seven. And, you know, about midway through the country on up, you have a lot of communities that depend on fishing. And it was there that the first pirates evolved, because they were fishermen who had been basically rendered jobless by these foreign fishing boats that were destroying the marine habitat. So they began to take ships hostage. And in one part of Somalia called Puntland, which is in northeastern Somalia, you had a real proliferation of piracy. And that today remains one of the most pirate-infested parts of the country. And that's because it's in the northern part of Somalia. And again, it's right near this very congested shipping channel, the Gulf of Aden, which links the Indian Ocean to the Red Sea.
This is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're tracing the history of piracy, in particular, the growth of piracy off the coast of Somalia. Although piracy began as a method of protecting Somali fishing grounds, it quickly developed into a very profitable business.
Since the Somali fishermen cannot now engage in a meaningful way of living, raising an income to sustain themselves, they have now to go to piracy as an alternative to raise money to make a living. But although initially that was the cause, what one sees subsequently happening is that people, or certain people who are not themselves pirates, began financing piracy as a way of making business. And therefore they would purchase weapons, they would harm these fishermen, tell them to go and hijack, of course at a fee, and therefore the ransom paid goes to them. So it became like an industry, it became like a sector in itself, whereby now people are talking in terms of investing money to get returns.
I think it started to change in the early 2000s. And by 2005, 2006, you had pirates attacking oil tankers, sailing yachts, cargo ships, you know, ships that had nothing to do with fishing. And they were charging a couple $100,000 in ransom. They'd hold the ship for a few weeks. The shipping owner would give them $100,000. They'd let the ship go. Then in 2007, 2008, we saw a real sharp increase in these ransoms, going up to like $1 million. And that started because these pirates would attack oil tankers far away from Somalia's shores. And this was no longer an issue about protecting Somalia's shoreline. This was opportunistic crime attacking any ship they could get their hands on. And today, what we're talking about is they're attacking ships 1,000 miles away from Somalia, closer to India than Africa, and they are charging up to $5 or $6 million, sometimes as much as $10 million, to give the ship back. And that's why we're seeing more and more people jump into the business, because it's so lucrative and there are so few economic opportunities in Somalia that piracy becomes one of the biggest job creators and income earners in the country.
In my opinion, the big change actually started in spring 2008 with the attack on a French luxury yacht, the Le Ponant, which netted the pirates a cool ransom of $2 million. You see, before that event, pirates usually got away with six-digit amounts of ransoms. That's nothing to scoff at, but it's nothing actually that triggers your imagination if you're living away from the shores. But $2 million, that was such a huge figure that it led to a kind of a gold rush or feeding frenzy, where lots of young militia men actually flocked to the shores to get a piece of the action. Which also means the composition of pirate groups changed. It was not longer only a fisherman. It was a gaggle of fishermen providing the mariner skills and militia guys providing the military muscles. And this is where the problem actually started and grew into this security threat that we currently see.
Most Somali pirates are young men who are heavily armed, don't have much of an education, because most people in Somalia at this point don't have much of an education. The school system basically collapsed in 1991, so you have a whole generation of young men that didn't go to school at all. And these pirates are uneducated, heavily armed, and opportunistic, and some of the pirate bosses that I've met, they're quite intelligent. They're savvy businessmen that have figured out a way to graft Somalia's lawlessness onto the world's economy and to make a lot of money out of this business. They tend to be in their 20s, 30s, some of them in their 40s. You know, a lot of them are very thin. Many of them are addicted to khat, which is this leaf that people chew in Somalia that suppresses your appetite. It's a mild drug that gives you a slight high, but one of the results is it kind of withers away your physique. And a lot of these guys, they're in it for the money. They're not investing the money in what we would consider a wise way. They're blowing it on cars, on alcohol, on prostitutes, on drugs. And they'll admit this. I've spoken to some big pirate bosses that have had millions of dollars pass through their hands, and these guys are essentially broke. And I said, well, what happened to all the money that you've made? And they say, well, if you don't really know how to handle money, you don't invest it wisely. If you've never had it, you don't know what to do with it. And we blew it on cars, on women, on parties, things like that.
They are very clever in understanding, as pirates have to be very clever, in understanding their adversary, their victims. What they're really doing here is using ships as a leverage to get insurance. It's worth far more to the ship owners simply to pay up or the insurance companies to pay up than it is for them to defend themselves. So they take ships back to these harbors that are so risible, they're not really harbors at all. And really what they're doing is less capturing the ships and the cargo as they're capturing the crew and holding them hostage. There's no question that they've been richly rewarded. I mean, the first ships that were captured before it really took off literally were bought off with helicopters were flying in and dumping cash into the sea. I mean, big bundles of bills, euros, dollars, were being dropped in bags that could, you know, not dropped and lost, but dropped to these people. And they go, money from heaven. What could be better than this? This is like everything we ever dreamed of. And naturally, it created a whole culture of piracy. And now you have this money being spent to renovate some of these towns, which were basically just nomad camps originally. And people are building these large villas and driving around in black Toyota Land Cruisers and having a great old time.
Over the last year in 2008, piracy generated somewhere between $50 and $80 million in ransom.
I don't know. I don't have the figures yet, but in terms of ransom payments, it is very, very huge. One talks of millions of dollars. And we don't have the exact figures, of course, but those who have assessed it as are talking of millions of dollars and therefore very profitable.
The incredible amount of money coming in to the pirates from the ransoms, what impact is that having on the Somali economy in these areas and also on the culture of Somalia?
Well, that's a really good question. On the economy, it is employing thousands of people. And that's what's interesting about piracy. It's very organic now to these coastal communities of Somalia. There are so many people involved, from the pirates themselves to the gunmen that guard the ships once they're on shore, to the people that fix the boats, that fix the engines, that provide food to the pirates and to their hostages, the women that sell them tea, to accountants, to the people that scrutinize the payments of the dollars, because all these ransoms are paid in U.S. dollars cash, and you need people to verify whether the money is real or not. So you have tens of thousands of people that are now wrapped up in this criminal enterprise. It has had some effect on the culture. There are a lot of people that think the pirates are un-Islamic, that they do things like drink alcohol and frequent prostitutes and do drugs, and that's kind of a stain on the Islamic culture of Somalia. Somalia is a very conservative, traditional place, even though it was never really a incubator until recently of violent, militant Islam. It's a very traditional place. People take religion seriously, they take their tradition seriously, and these pirates are seen as an interruption to that.
And what about that connection you mentioned between some of the more Islamic groups today and the pirates?
So from what we know, the pirates are using, they've expanded their onshore bases across the country, and some of the places they work are controlled by these Islamic groups like the Shabab. So in order for the pirates to work from, let's say, Brawa, which is a town in southern Somalia controlled by the Shabab, they have to pay the Shabab some money. There's a big piracy lair called Haradere in central Somalia that's now controlled by the Shabab also. And for the pirates to continue using the beaches there, they have to give the Islamists a cut of their ransom, 10 to 20%.
So in essence, it's a working relationship. It's not like there is a strong kind of ideological connection between the two.
Not at all. And the information we have is the Islamists aren't going to sea. It's not like you have Shabab hijacking ships. They're just getting a percentage of the ransoms to allow the pirates to work from their areas.
Off the Horn of Africa, in the middle of the world's busiest shipping lanes, heavily armed warships are playing a seafaring game of cat and mouse. Their quarry, pirates.
There's been a few different things tried. There's been a lot of Navy warships that are patrolling the seas. There have been some pirates that have been prosecuted in Kenya and Europe and the United States. But despite all the resources being poured into the battle against piracy, it really hasn't had much of an impact. And there were more attacks last year than the year before. And in 2009, there were more attacks than 2008. So we're seeing a steady increase of piracy attacks and hijackings despite all this attention.
Well, I would say that has not succeeded, I'm sorry to say. Because if you look at the level of naval involvement, the military intervention, very many vessels deployed to cover a huge area. But even when those vessels are there, we have had hijackings taking place. And this is what makes, again, this Somali piracy very interesting. Despite this heavy naval presence, you still have hijackings taking place. And therefore, one is left to ask, is military intervention the solution? Yes, partly it is a solution because there has been deterrence. Part of the mandate of these forces there is to deter and prevent piracy. To some extent they have. But you see now, they are operating within the framework of international law. And what has been happening, of course, is that in some of the situations where the countries involved are not very clear as to what would happen after they arrest these pirates and whether they can succeed in prosecuting them and having them convicted within their national jurisdiction, they then adopt the so-called catch and release policy, where they catch, disarm, destroy, and release. Now, don't forget, once that happens, the same persons who have been released go back home, they get refinanced, get back to the sea, and therefore it becomes a vicious circle.
Clearly, if you look back in history, say if you go back to Roman times, the Romans solved the problem of piracy in the Mediterranean by basically starting at one end and sweeping all their way across and destroying the pirate lairs through the Mediterranean. But I'm wondering, in a modern day time, what is possible now?
Well, Pompeius at that time also bought over lots of pirates, and maybe that's something we should do now, trying to convince the pirates in Puntland that they should actually act as a coast guard and have a decent income. But anyway, coming back to the lessons of history, it's quite difficult. I know that some observers are talking about going back to land and destroying the pirate infrastructure there, as we have done in the Barbary Coast Wars in the early 1800s, as was done in Somalia before in the 19th century by the British Navy, or along the Chinese coast also in the 19th century by several navies like the Royal Navy and US Navy. Having said that, making the rubber bounce, as the saying goes, is quite difficult nowadays because you have collateral damage. You see, who is a pirate? And these are not the people with wooden packs and parrots on the shoulder. They simply merge with the population as soon as they are on land. So it's difficult to pinpoint them. It's also difficult to destroy the infrastructure because they don't need much sophisticated infrastructure to operate. So taking the fight to the land will be quite difficult, I must say. And this will actually bring water to the mill of Al-Shabaab, that this is yet another crusade of Western infidels against the Muslim nation. And you do remember that the West was already in Somalia in the early 1990s, Operation Restore Hope. And we all know what happened with that. I think everybody has seen the movie Black Hawk Down. So I think nobody is too eager actually to go back into Somalia.
Peter Lear, lecturer in terrorism studies at the University of St Andrews, ending today's program. Our other guests were Paul Musili Wambua, Professor of Law at the University of Nairobi. Jeffrey Gentleman, East African Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Angus Compston, Historian of Piracy. And Bob Davis, Professor of History at Ohio State University. Thanks to sound engineer Jennifer Parsonage and to ABC Foreign Correspondent for archival material. Don't forget to keep checking the Rear Vision website, because every week we put up relevant material on our special features page, and we now have hundreds of programs in our archives. So it's a great resource for anyone who wants more than just the headlines. That's at abc.net.au/rn/Rear Vision. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. Thanks for your company.